West. 7. Uprisings. I had just turned 10 and I was still living in Jordan when an uprising began in the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza after an Israeli army truck had plowed into a line of cars waiting at a checkpoint, killing 4 Palestinians. Many thousands of Palestinians had been killed by Israeli forces over the years, but this incident was the spark in the tinderbox. In Gaza, in the West Bank, and in East Jerusalem, Palestinians rose to protest the Israeli military occupation. For the most part, the protesters were unarmed civilians. They erected barricades. They took part in mass demonstrations and general strikes. They boycotted Israeli products. They refused to pay taxes. They scribbled graffiti on walls. Although they sometimes fought back against Israeli troops by throwing stones or Molotov cocktails, the UNLP, the Unified National Leadership of the Uprising, deliberately discouraged the use of firearms in favor of civil disobedience. Seldom guilty of underreacting, Israel deployed some 70,000 soldiers to quell these acts of resistance. Israeli forces began by using live ammunition, but as the number of civilian deaths rose and the United Nations Security Council condemned Israeli policy, the soldiers were equipped instead with clubs, supplemented by rubber-coated metal bullets and plastic bullets. By the end of the first year of the uprising, 332 Palestinians were dead. According to Wendy Perlman in her book, Violence, Nonviolence, and the Palestinian National Movement, Israeli casualties stood at 12. This uprising came to be known as the First Intifada. It began in December 1987 and lasted for 6 years. When I was in grade 7, one of my friends, Nuno, came to my house hoping to play video games, Super Mario, Blades of Steel, Duck Hunt. We both loved the hollow sound of the spring clicking inside the orange and gray Nintendo gun as we fired at targets. He waited outside while I asked my mother for permission to invite him in. "Is he Muslim?" she asked. He wasn't. "Is he Arabic?" Again, I had to say no. "Then I don't want you playing with him. He doesn't belong to our religion and culture." My mother knew that my dad was always worried we would integrate and forget our heritage and religion if he didn't monitor our friendships. That never happened, and Nuno and I are friends to this day. I glared at her. I couldn't see what religion and culture had to do with playing Nintendo, but I knew it was hopeless to argue with her. I went back outside and said, "Not today, Nuno." I was embarrassed. I was back in Canada trying again to be normal, but my mother was making this impossible. It was as if she loved the idea of being an outsider. If there had been an all-Muslim school in Edmonton, I would have been in it, but there wasn't, so my parents, mostly my mother, found ways to make up for it. On weekends, we would spend all our free time at the Al-Rashid Mosque or go to visit other Muslim families. The only parties I was allowed to attend were those organized by the mosque or by the Canadian Arab Friendship Association. I had the feeling that my mom thought I would end up in some kind of hell for children if I went to a real party, the kind that Canadian kids had. But then my mother never had any non-Muslim friends either. "So what did you come back to Canada for?" I wanted to ask her. "Aren't we all supposed to be multicultural?" I remember being sent to a retreat for youth organized by the Al-Rashid Mosque when I was in my early teens. I resented the experience, and, like a typical teenager, I held my mother responsible for my misfortune. When I got back from the camp, I tried to get back at my mother for sending me. If she wanted me to be more Muslim, I reasoned, I'd give her what she wanted. I started eating with my hands, the way I'd seen some other Muslim friends do. My efforts were met with a curt, "Stop eating with your hands." "That's what they taught me at the retreat," I'd reply. And so it would continue. The bickering seldom stopped, and although we are best of friends now, I cannot recall many conversations with my mother from that time in my life that did not involve fighting. My selfishness made me overlook the many things she did for us, like taking us to piano or swimming lessons, or taking us to the library or taekwondo. At the time, I just resented her and her inability to adjust to a Canadian way of life as I saw it. It didn't help that my name, properly transliterated from Arabic, is spelt M-O-W-A-F-A-Q. The kids loved it. Mo fuck you, they would yell in the schoolyard to embarrass me. So in grade 7, while I was still at Killarney Junior High, I changed my name to Mo. A lot of my friends did the same thing. Chadi became Chad. Muhammad called himself Mike. Saeed became Sid. But it didn't really help. An Arab by any other name is still an Arab. In grade 8, after the start of the first Gulf War in August 1990, my Arab friends and I got called names like Camel Jockey or Packy. The antagonism made us feel alienated and rebellious. At home, I wasn't Muslim enough, and at school, I was not allowed to forget I was a Muslim. I was a moody kid, at once self-conscious about my ethnic background, and yet ready to defend it at the drop of a hat. Part of me was desperate to fit in, and part of me was angry that I wasn't allowed to, not by my mother and not by white kids at school. Like most adolescents, I was also keenly sensitive to differences in social and economic status, and this was another source of pain. My family was managing to get by, but it wasn't like the old days before my father lost his business in the fire. At that age, though, I had little understanding of household finances, nor did I care. To me, my mother just seemed clueless. She would buy me clothes at the Byway store, a betrayal that made me want to disappear. Nothing was more humiliating than the Byway brand logo. We were on the wrong side of the line between those who didn't have to shop at discount warehouses that reeked of sweatshop adhesives and those who did. At school, everyone made fun of people who bought anything other than chocolate bars and gum at Byway. When I saw the store bags come home, I wanted to explode. I would beg my mother not to go there, but she didn't understand. We did not have a nice car. We had an old Pontiac, a burgundy station wagon. I didn't want my friends to see it, so I would get my mom to drop me off 3 or 4 blocks from the school. My excuse was always the same. I just feel like walking. I didn't know it at the time, but I was doing the same thing my father had done back in the refugee camp, trying to keep up false appearances to avoid feeling ashamed. As I struggled with my identity in Canada, trying to sort through warring emotions that pulled me in two directions, the Intifada continued in the occupied territories. My father and Uncle Faisal followed the resistance movement closely, and my parents and other family members often talked about it. Some were very worried, especially my mother, who had a sister living in a camp in Mukayam Balata, which was located adjacent to Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Many of the casualties were ordinary women and children attempting to defend their neighborhoods. Schools were closed. Utilities were cut off. Homes were demolished. People were arrested and jailed. Accounts of the Intifada are full of statistics. In sufficient quantity, numbers work like anesthetic, allowing us to blot out our feelings. But a few stand out for me. During the first 2 years of the Intifada, an estimated 23,600 to 29,900 Palestinian children required medical treatment for injuries sustained in beatings. Arthur Neslin points out in Your Eyes a Sandstorm, Ways of Being Palestinian, that a third of these children were under 10 years old, younger than I was when it started. In those 2 years, children died at an average of 1 every 5 days. Some were victims of tear gas, others died from beatings or from gunshot wounds, or from burns. Of these children, 35% were under 11, 19% were less than a year old. In 1993, when I was nearly 16, Israel and the PLO signed the first Oslo Accord, thus marking an end to the uprising. By then, upwards of 1,200 Palestinians, the majority of them unarmed civilians, had been killed by Israeli forces since the Intifada began. News images of Israeli soldiers viciously clubbing Palestinian youth had at one point evoked a certain sympathy in the West for our struggle in Gaza and the West Bank, but by 1993 this compassion had largely evaporated. In Edmonton, as elsewhere, the mood had turned against Palestine. 8. Fighting Back. I remember how, when I was a little kid, I loved to watch morning cartoons. In one of them, I forget which, a Middle Eastern sheikh figure sometimes appeared with his flowing robes and turban. He was always up to no good, sometimes lecherous, sometimes conniving, always greedy. At the time, I did not see the stereotype that was being portrayed. I just thought he was funny. As I grew older, I became increasingly aware of being stereotyped myself, but it never seemed to occur to me that I was just as ready to stereotype other children. The abuse I endured at Killarney Junior High had made me very unhappy, and so my parents decided it was best to change schools in grade 8. Dickensfield Junior High had a substantial minority of Muslim students who came from the large Arab Canadian community in the area. The reason for this larger Arab presence in the area was, in part, because many refugees were allocated government housing in the Castle Downs or Dickensfield neighborhoods when they arrived. Other immigrants followed them there to be closer to communities in which they felt more welcome. I used the change of school to change my image, as I wanted to be seen as cool rather than as a loser. Besides, my best friend Bashar attended Dickensfield, as did my cousins. However, the first Gulf War broke out shortly before the start of the new school year, and that brought a new set of problems that pulled me right back into the cycle I had tried to escape by coming to Dickensfield. One morning, not too long after the school year started, I saw a white student taping a picture of Saddam Hussein to the door of his locker. Anti-Saddam sentiments were running high in Canada, and the poster was intended to be a target that other students could spit and throw things at as they shouted things like, "Dirty Arab." Others shouted, "I hope they kill that packy." I didn't know a whole lot about Saddam Hussein, but I knew he wasn't from Pakistan. I also knew that I wasn't an Iraqi. That didn't seem to matter, though, and it bothered me a lot. If I ever confused Canadians with Americans, I'd be in trouble. So how come white people couldn't keep their Arabs straight? Life at school was hard. If we had had support from the adults at school, things might have been different, but the teachers, principals, and community were openly racist towards us. I do not remember having any teachers in Dickensfield or later at M.E. Lazert who was a person of color. This racism led me to develop an animosity that bordered on hatred for white people in positions of power. We were the real outsiders. We were the unwanted. I was at a rebellious age, and in this atmosphere of hatred, spurred by the Gulf War, the only outlet that some of the Arab kids could find was to engage in gang culture. The black, Italian, and Chinese students all had their groups, and so Arab kids gravitated towards each other in the same way. Outside of school, things were much the same. Wherever I went, I could hear people talking, saying things like, "Saddam Hussein, such an awful man, such a tyrant, such a murderer." That was all I heard on the news and all around me in Edmonton. Stories circulated about how he and his sons tortured people for fun, how he was like an Arab Hitler, and how Canadians were proud that their country was sending troops to help defeat him. It seemed like a lopsided encounter to me, this huge coalition led by the United States, heading into the desert to rid the world of one evil dictator. At home, whenever family and friends visited, there would be long discussions of the Gulf War. As I understood it, Iraq claimed that Kuwait was part of its own territory, that the British had created an artificial country, and it was also accusing Kuwait of siphoning off oil from Iraqi oil fields. The United States was no friend of Iraq, and it wanted to prevent oil-rich Kuwait from falling under Iraqi control. It seemed to me even then that the fight wasn't really about Saddam Hussein, it was about oil. My parents and their friends were concerned about the long-term ramifications of the war and the implications it would have for Palestinians. Over the years, the PLO had received support from both Iraq and Kuwait, and Yasser Arafat had learned to balance his Palestinian interests and broader regional interests well. Now, however, the region was divided, and Arafat found himself in a difficult position. Iraq was insisting on a resolution of the Palestinian problem as a precondition to its withdrawal from Kuwait, while Kuwait supported Western military intervention. If he supported military intervention, he'd lose the support of Iraq, but if he didn't, he'd lose the support of Kuwait. To make Arafat's dilemma even more complicated, Kuwait was home to some 400,000 Palestinian refugees, and siding with Iraq could affect Kuwait's attitude towards them. Arafat was opposed to Western intervention in what he viewed as an Arab crisis, and in the end, he decided to throw his lot in with Iraq. Kuwait publicly condemned the PLO for opposing Western military intervention. Many of the Muslim adults I overheard in our home approved of Saddam Hussein's strategy. I would hear things like, "He may be a brutal dictator, but at least he has the guts to stand up to Israel." But some worried that if it came to military action, Iraq would surely be defeated by the U.S.-led coalition. Then what would become of the Palestinian population in Kuwait, especially now that the country had turned against the PLO? The imam of the Al-Rashid Mosque, Youssef Chebli, was among those who refused to portray Saddam Hussein as wholly evil. Although he was critical of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, he openly praised Hussein for his continued support of the Palestinian cause. Chebli was also an outspoken critic of Western militarism. As he saw it, military action against Iraq would inevitably put civilian lives at risk. When the assault on Iraq finally began in mid-January 1991, Chebli publicly castigated Canada for its role in what he called the Satanic Coalition. The local press had a field day. "Local Muslim cleric sees Saddam as God's agent," the Edmonton Journal announced. "Muslim backs hero Saddam," screamed the Edmonton Sun. Suddenly, our imam was a Saddam lover. He was also the recipient of death threats, and it was not long before the Canadian Security Intelligence Service paid him a visit. The local Muslim community was divided over Chebli. Some of my parents' friends admired his willingness to dissent from mainstream opinion and to present another side of the story, while others were embarrassed by his outspokenness and attempted to distance themselves from his views. Yet others were angry. They argued that he was too antagonistic and blamed him for inviting attacks on the city's Muslim residents, as well as for the vandalism at the mosque. Some seemed uncertain about how they felt. For my part, I always had a lot of respect and admiration for Imam Chebli. When my parents were going through their divorce, he spent many nights at our house trying to help them reconcile. He was always generous. But regardless of whether Chebli was kind to me and my family or whether his remarks made matters worse for Palestinians, the fact remains that what was happening in Edmonton was happening all across the country. In the end, no Canadians died fighting in the Gulf War. The victims were right here in Canada, ordinary people who happened to be Muslim and/or Arab, or who looked like they might be. On the streets, Arab teens were getting jumped by white gangs, and women wearing hijabs were harassed or sometimes outright assaulted. Mosques were being desecrated. Muslim homes and businesses were being vandalized, and imams were receiving hate mail. Even Sikhs were getting called lebs or dirty Arabs. It was as if the war had tapped into a wellspring of racism, giving people permission to let loose. I was too young to analyze the situation fully and to understand why us needs a them. But I did understand what it felt like to be insulted and shoved, and why my father was worried about letting my mother go out alone. Watching students at my school spit on a picture of Saddam Hussein, I felt like they were doing it to me. My parents began spending more time at the mosque, and so did other families we knew. People felt isolated, unwanted, angry, frightened, confused, and often bitter. They needed a place to cling together, to talk about what was happening, and to support one another. The mosque offered such a space. Even my father started to attend the Friday sermons and the weekday evening lectures. Before the Gulf War, the focus at the mosque was mostly spiritual. Now it was political. Although Iraq invaded Kuwait on the 2nd of August 1990, fighting between Iraq and the Western coalition's forces did not start until January 1991. The intervening time was spent preparing for the war and consolidating support in the West. During that time, a couple of Arab students from Dickensfield Junior High were beaten up by a group of white students while they were on their way home from school. At that time, I was one of the more outspoken students at the school, and many of my peers looked to me as a leader. Their bruises didn't prevent these kids from walking or talking, and they came and told me what had happened. Although they were more scared than hurt, I could feel things changing. I was angry about the wave of anti-Muslim sentiment that the invasion had unleashed, and I reacted by asserting my Arab and Islamic identity. At school, as a symbol of rebellion, I started to wear the Palestinian keffiyeh, the scarf that Yasser Arafat always wore. Somewhere in all of this was a desire to show that Arab is cool. I started to attend events at the mosque more often with my family. I even requested that the school allocate a space to students for the weekly Friday prayer. To my surprise, my request was granted. So there I was, fronting like some 13-year-old imam, giving Friday sermons to my fellow students. I wasn't even sure how to perform the Friday prayer ritual, but I did it anyway, recycling lectures I heard at the mosque. Around the same time as these world events were unfolding and I began to retreat into myself in an effort to cope, some of my friends and I started hanging out at the Canadian Arab Friendship Association, which was located in the Dickensfield Mall, just a few blocks away from the school on 144th Avenue. CAFA was established in 1965 by several members of the Arab community who wanted to ensure that their cultural heritage would be preserved for their children. The association also worked to promote an appreciation of Arab traditions in the broader community. One of the people who volunteered at CAFA was Uncle Yazan, who became the father figure I needed at the time. Uncle Yazan is not related to me, but he treated me like a son, and I respected him as though he were family, so I called him Uncle. Uncle Yazan became my mentor and taught me more about Arabic culture and history than anyone had done up to that point in my life. I'd first met Uncle Yazan before I started going to CAFA, and I confess, I started going there mostly to be with him. We met when I got into a fight with a Turkish boy named Baha. Baha and I were going at each other outside the Happy Pop store at the Dickensfield Mall when the police showed up. Baha fled, and I ran into the Burger Baron restaurant further down the mall. I had heard that an Arab man called Yazan owned the store and thought I might be safe there. Even though I didn't know him, I trusted him based on the things I'd heard about him. Uncle Yazan hid me in the restaurant's storage room. When the cops came into the Burger Baron to ask questions, Uncle Yazan told them, "It was nothing, just a couple of young kids having a fight." The police asked for names, but Yazan said he couldn't give them any. After they left, Yazan called people he knew and tracked down Baha. He made him come to the store and then sat the two of us down to resolve the problem. I hadn't realized that Baha was Muslim. He looked more European than Arab. We made our peace, and I went home feeling rather remorseful. It was that day that Uncle Yazan took me under his wing. "Come and see me," he said, "every week if you can." And I did. By grade 11, we had built a close friendship, and he used to tease me when he saw me come through the doors at CAFA by calling me Mr. Arafat because I wore a keffiyeh just like Yasser Arafat did. Maybe a month after my fight with Baha, I was at the Northgate Transit Center near the Northgate Mall with my pal Bashar and another friend, Chadi, who was older than we were. They were cool, good-looking guys, smart guys, but also guys who wouldn't back down from a street fight. Chadi was in a bad mood that day because he had just broken up with his girlfriend and needed someone to blame. "Let's pick a fight," he said. Bashar objected, but I wanted to impress Chadi. I did not want to do it, but I was desperate to belong, and besides, I'd been taught to respect my elders, and Chadi was older than I was. As a young Arab boy growing up in northeast Edmonton, which had a reputation for being a tough area, I understood instinctively that people did not mess with the tough guys. I hoped that getting into a fight alongside Chadi, I would build my reputation as a tough guy and improve my social standing. So, to prove how tough I was, I looked around for the largest white guy, who happened to be about 17, and stood 3 inches taller than me. He looked like a skater, all laid back in a crowd of white kids who thought they were very cool. I sauntered up to him and said, "Hey, buddy, give me a cigarette." He stared at me. "I don't smoke," he answered. Then I pushed him, and he pushed back. That was all Chadi needed. He jumped in and started to fight with the guy, who fought back, hard. It was short but violent and resulted in bruises and bloody noses. As the guy climbed onto his bus, he pointed at me and shouted, "You coward, just you wait. I'll be back." I will never forget his words as the bus drove off. "I am coming for you." A few days later, Byron and his friends did come for me. At lunch one day, Bashar and I headed out to the Dickensfield Mall. We planned to get slushies at the Happy Pop store and play Mortal Kombat in the arcade. As we were on our way, two young Arab kids who were in grade 7 at Dickensfield came running up. They told me that some white guys were cruising around looking for me. "Let's go back to the school," Bashar said. "Come on, I have a reputation to protect. I don't back down." The kids were staring at me, waiting to see what I would do. I'd been stung by being called a coward, and if word got out that I'd run from a fight, that would be it for my image at school. So I took off my jacket and said I would defend myself. "No," Bashar shouted. "Go back to school and wait it out." I should have listened to Bashar. 3 cars pulled up at the side of the road. About 10 white guys got out and started walking towards me. They were older than me, obviously in high school. Bashar was yelling at me, "Run, you idiot!" But I stood my ground, trying to convince myself that I could take it. Suddenly I was surrounded. Some of the boys had sticks, while others were rotating their fists in the air. Out of the middle of the mob came Byron, the guy from the transit center. "I told you I would come back for you," he said. I thought they were all going to attack me, but he told them to stay back. The only thing I remember after that was that Bashar and another student, Linda, picked me up off the ground and walked me to the nursing station at the school, where I was cleaned up. The principal called my father to come and pick me up from school. News of the beating spread like wildfire in the community. Many of the students at Dickensfield were angry about what had happened to me. What they heard was that 50 kids, most of them white, had showed up to jump me. I didn't bother to correct their version of the events. When my father arrived at school, he was furious. He had brought a friend of his, Uncle Yusef Chahimi, with him. I'd been too scared to tell my father about the fight I'd started at the bus terminal, and now the two of them wanted the school to bring criminal charges against the attackers. The principal said that he was deeply sorry about what had happened, but because it had happened outside of the school grounds, it was a police matter, and there was nothing he could do. Technically, he was correct. The principal's authority stopped at the boundary of the school grounds. However, he could have offered to speak to the children involved, or he could have set up a program to foster greater understanding. But that was not how things went those days, especially not during the height of anti-Arab sentiment during the Gulf War. Uncle Yusef was a tough guy like the Joe Pesci character in Goodfellas. "Listen to me," he said. "If you don't do it your way, we will do it our way." When my father and Uncle Yusef left the office, they were fuming. Yet, despite their threatening words, they didn't actually do anything. It would just make things worse, they figured. What with the Gulf War and all. I was scared and regretted my actions. It was only recently, after I was diagnosed with ADHD, that I came to realize how much of my impulsive behavior as a child may have been the result of that disorder rather than just my troubled family life and my anger at what was happening in the Middle East. My father and Uncle Yusef may have decided to leave matters be, but others were in no mood to do that, and since I was in the middle of the situation, I got pulled into planning the revenge. I simply did not have the courage or maturity to stand up to my friends at the time. We met at CAFA under the auspices of a youth meeting. Our plan was to collect some sticks to use as weapons and then to gather at Northgate Mall bus terminal after school. From there, we would go together to Bishop O'Leary School, which is where Byron and his friends went to school. I did not want to go. I was hurting emotionally, and I was wrestling with the situation and my role in it. I still do. By noon, about 60 of us were waiting outside the Bishop O'Leary. Some had walked, others came in cars. Ahmad, an old-school Palestinian, had managed to stuff more than 12 people into his family's minivan. To my embarrassment, my father was there too, standing on the sidewalk outside the school. I could see some kind of metal bar in his hands. I couldn't believe it. What did he think he was doing? My father was never violent. Whether I was embarrassed at the sight of him carrying a metal bar or at my own presence in the midst of this violence when that was not the way I had been raised, I am not sure. My only course of action, I felt, was to avoid my father. I withdrew to the sidelines, out of view, and racked with guilt at the thought that the events that were unfolding had happened because of me. I watched my father and the other people who had gathered approach the school. I watched my dad move to the sidelines, but still I was ashamed. I realize now that the only way my father knew how to show solidarity with the injustice that had been visited on his son was to be a bystander. But then I saw only that I had let him down and had forced him to engage in uncharacteristic violence. Then a random white guy yelled at my father, "Get out of here before I beat you up, you fucking packy." My father responded by waving the metal rod in his hands defiantly before getting back into his car and moving it to the other side of the street, further down the block. That was when I realized that my mother was with him. I don't know why. The whole thing seemed crazy. Perhaps they were simply scared of what was going to happen and wanted to be there regardless. Or perhaps my father was content to stand by and watch while other people fought for his son. I could not tell. And did my mother want to witness this revenge as well? I remembered her strength when she ripped the Oilers cap off me and smashed my sunglasses and wondered whether she planned to join the fray. I could picture the headlines, "Avenging Arab Mom Unleashes Fury Upon High School Kids." Byron and his skater friends were nowhere to be seen in the schoolyard, so we headed inside the school to look for him. Still no luck. So we went after anyone we thought looked like a skater or a headbanger. Basically, white dude with long hair parted to one side, baggy clothes, and skateboard became a legitimate target. We were an angry mob of youngsters who were determined to frighten anyone who would attack one of our own. After about 10 minutes of fighting and mayhem, we ran off before the police showed up. Looking back, it seems like a sad thing to feel proud of, but I felt proud. I had seen how our community could close ranks in defense of one of our own. Guys I didn't even know had been willing to risk getting beaten up and maybe even arrested just to deliver a message. It felt like our own intifada in the middle of the Gulf War. 9. Wise mentors, rough waters. No matter how hard I tried to fit in at school, I constantly felt rejected. I responded by not wanting to have anything to do with white Anglo-Christian Canada. I wanted to be Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim, even though I did not understand what that really meant. At home, I felt pressure from my parents to hold on to my past and the history and customs of my people. I was an emotional powder keg, and the spark that lit the fuse was the first Gulf War. After 9/11, I remember seeing non-Muslims come to the mosque with flowers. That never happened in 1990. Furthermore, I struggled with Islam. Not with my faith per se, but with the definition of Islam that my parents saw, which was largely cultural and had little to do with Islam as a religion. Many of my friends and I were unsure of what Islam did and did not allow us to do in a Canadian cultural context. For instance, dating felt foreign, wrong, and sinful. We often wondered whether we might end up burning in hell for doing things that non-Muslim kids did. A lot of our frustration came out through fighting. Looking back, I can see that it was a constant battle for immigrant parents to try to raise their kids within their culture, but also within the reality of Canadian norms. Those parents who had endured urba, exile, and all that went with it, now had to battle with their kids who faced their own inherited displacement. After the Byron incident and our reprisal, I felt I had some kind of stupid tough guy image to maintain. It became cool to be bad, and I enjoyed the attention, even though I did not feel good about what I was doing. For the first time, I felt accepted and felt like I belonged. Younger kids at the school looked up to me, so I continued to behave in ways I now regret. Our attack at O'Leary High sparked fears that things would get worse and that the cycle of violence would continue. Community police officers and Arab community leaders organized a large meeting at O'Leary to call for a truce. We were sitting on one side of the hall, and Byron and the other skaters were on the other side, with the police and Uncle Yazan in the middle. The police officer started to talk. "We want to end this fight here and now, because if you guys don't, it will get worse, and we will have to lay charges." I remember my friend Majid saying to Byron, "You are lucky. If I had found you that day, I would have smashed your face in." Another fight almost broke out, but Uncle Yazan, whom we all looked up to and respected, intervened. His baritone voice grabbed our attention. "Sit down and don't make any more wise-ass comments like that," he said. At the end of the session, Byron and I apologized and shook hands. I was embarrassed about my part, an embarrassment I still feel today. I wish I could say it was all over and that I stopped getting into fights, but it wasn't. I continued to get into scraps, with my own people, too. One afternoon in home economics class, Bashar and I were talking about the Gulf War and got into an argument over who would come out victorious, Saddam or the United States. Bashar felt, as I and many others in the community did, that a defeat for Saddam was a defeat for Palestinians. But to egg me on, he said, "America is going to win and destroy Saddam." We started punching each other in the middle of the class. This led to another suspension. We were right, after all. Saddam lost the war, and the Palestinians in Kuwait lost their refuge. Palestinians had arrived in Kuwait in three different waves, in 1948, 1967, and 1975. By 1990, Kuwait, a country of only about 2 million, was full of Palestinian workers. The national demographics were threatened, and the expulsion began. In 1991, after Kuwait's liberation from Iraqi invasion, 300,000 Palestinians were expelled. Things have come full circle since then. During the uprisings of 2021, Kuwait has taken one of the most patriotic stands with the Palestinian people and has imposed a fine and a prison sentence of 10 years for any Kuwaiti who actively supports Israel. At the time of the Gulf War, I was a teenager, and I knew about the struggles my grandfather, my parents, and my family had endured simply to survive and resist oppression. With the expulsions happening in Kuwait, it seemed as though my father and uncles were reliving their own exile. Every time something like this happened, my father and my uncles felt like it was another strike at our people. It seemed like those who left during the 7-month occupation would never return to Kuwait. Kuwaiti officials suggested that the Palestinians could move to Jordan. It was always the same dilemma. Where do we go? Where do we belong? It is something I struggle with to this day, this search for a place to call home and put down roots. For as far back as I could remember, my parents had struggled with their marriage and with their relationship to us children. My father was always on the road as a traveling salesman, so we barely saw him or bonded with him. I know he has a good heart and is very, very generous and very forgiving. I also know that he enjoyed hanging out with his friends more than with his family. I never remember him taking us on a vacation or taking me with him on his sales trips. I used to beg him to take me with him while he traveled, but he never did. My mom is a kind, forgiving, and loving person who has never harmed anyone. She avoids confrontation wherever possible and is always ready to help others. She is also conservative and very spiritual and religious. Growing up, we watched the combination of their personalities build into a disaster. By 1992, the cracks in my parents' relationship had become chasms, and my own outbursts in and out of school did not help to settle our family's lives. To escape the chaos of life in Edmonton and to be away from my father, my mother decided to move to Montreal for a year to be near her sister. She took me and my brothers with her, hoping that removing us from that environment would help settle us. I was 15 at the time. We flew to Toronto and planned to take the train to Montreal the next day. We wandered with our suitcases around the cavernous lobby of the Royal York Hotel next to Union Station. My mom could not afford the $300 for a room, and we planned to wait overnight in the hotel lobby. My brothers and sister were getting restless. They were exhausted from the flight and needed to rest. We had been sitting on the couches, surrounded by our bags, for about 2 hours when a white woman who worked at the hotel approached my mom. "Are you okay?" she asked. "Yes, we are fine," my mom replied. "We are waiting for the train. We will be leaving in the morning." The woman asked my mom if she was a single mother. My mom nodded, wondering why she would ask such a strange question. The woman then asked if she could speak to my mother in private. My mom agreed, and they walked to the woman's office, which was near the lobby of the hotel. I watched through the doorway as the lady sat behind her office desk at a computer terminal, with my mother sitting on the opposite side. I could not hear what she was saying and was too young to read her body language. All I remember is that my mother was crying when she left the office. I wondered what the woman had said that had made my mother cry. Then I saw two sets of keys in her hands and realized they were tears of happiness. The woman had given us two free rooms for the six of us. Then I, too, wanted to cry, and I felt my body fill with hope that God was with her and was helping us. How good it felt, as the oldest, to put one of those sets of keys into the door lock of a hotel room. Once inside, it felt like we had stepped into a dream with fancy decor and pillows everywhere. We kids jumped on the beds and eventually fell asleep to rest for the next leg of our journey. We even received a courtesy wake-up call the next morning and staff to help us with our baggage. I wish to this day that I could find that woman to thank her for what she did for my mother and to tell her that my mother has paid that gift forward in her own way, too. My mother has given back that generosity many times over. To this day, my mother helps people. I remember in my second year at university, I went to visit her in Richmond, BC, where she had rented a small basement suite. One night, she asked me and my brother Belal to sleep on the couch so that she could let an abused woman who needed shelter stay in our room. I may have been a troubled youth, but I have learned from her, and I try to live by similar values. The train ride to Montreal seemed to go by very quickly after the long flight and a good night's rest. When we arrived, my aunt and uncle picked us up at the train station. Having no place of our own, we stayed with them for a couple of weeks. As the house was very cramped, I decided to ride the bus and look for a place to live. One day, I stumbled on a three-bedroom apartment for $700 a month in Saint-Laurent near the Côte-Vertu subway stop. It was in an area with a high concentration of Arabs called Al-Mukayam, which means the refugee camp. I told my mom about it when I got home, and she came to look at it with me the next day. She signed the lease right away. She then arranged for the boxes containing our possessions to be shipped from Edmonton. When the boxes arrived, they filled the new space with a mountain of cardboard that gradually disappeared as we unpacked and restarted our lives. I started grade 10 at Émile Legault Secondary, where the students came from a variety of backgrounds, and the student body included Arabs, Muslims, Christians, and Lebanese. As an expression of my style and identity, I wore my black and white Palestinian keffiyeh to school. One day I was approached by three guys. They pushed me against my locker and spoke loudly in French, which I struggled to understand. Then they switched to Arabic. They wanted me to take off my keffiyeh, and they were quite blunt about it. That much was clear, regardless of the language they chose to speak. I hated being outnumbered like this. I did not comply, but fortunately a mutual friend turned up at that moment to stick up for me, and nothing more serious happened to me. One of our neighbors, a Lebanese girl named Lillian, and I had become friends soon after we had moved into the apartment in Al-Mukayyam. I would walk home with her after school every day, and I learned later that the guys who had roughed me up were Lebanese Christians and did not like Palestinians, especially not Palestinian Muslim boys, hanging around Lillian. Later that year, I was getting a caricature drawn of myself at the harborfront. I was staring at it intently, trying to decide if it really looked like me and whether the artist had captured the real me under the exaggeration. When I looked up, I saw two guys trying to pick up girls. I knew they were Lebanese, but they were wearing necklace chains with the Star of David on them. Curious, I asked if they were Jewish. They laughed and said, "No, we are Christian Lebanese, but more girls talk to us when we say we are Jewish." I thought of my own attempts at disguising my identity. I would sometimes say that I was Spanish, and some people thought so anyway, because of how similar Hausa and Jose sound. Sometimes I realized then it was simply too much trouble being Arab or Palestinian, regardless of whether you were Muslim or Christian. And I thought again of the boys who had roughed me up, wondering why Arabs could not simply let other Arabs be. The year in Montreal sped by, and I was just settling in nicely when my mother announced that we were returning to Edmonton. My father had come to Montreal to visit, and I realize now to woo my mother into returning to Edmonton. I remember he made it seem like he had lots of money to spend on things, like a rented car. He even went to the local mosque and brought some people over to show my mom that he had changed. He told her how he had changed and made promises about how everything would be great. He is a salesman, after all, and knows how to be a showman when he needs to be. My mom was reluctant, but she genuinely loved my father, so we packed up our apartment and moved back to Edmonton. Initially, my mom moved back in with my father. I had grown accustomed to not living under my father's thumb, and it felt awkward to be back under his authority. Soon the old, familiar tensions that had driven us to Montreal returned, and my mom moved out again, taking my siblings with her to Vancouver. I chose to stay in Edmonton and live independently. A year older and much wiser for the insights I had gained while in Montreal, I calmed down after moving out of my father's house again and began spending more time with people like Uncle Yazan at the Canadian Arab Friendship Association. For me, he remains one of the most intelligent and dynamic people in the Arab community in Edmonton. Uncle Yazan is both an idealist and a realist. He believed then, as he still does, that Muslims and Arabs are the best of people and are making a beneficial contribution to Canadian society. When we were growing up, he wanted to show us young people how we could contribute in positive ways. He wanted us to be proud of who we were and to discover the many contributions Arabs have made to the world through the centuries in areas like medicine, ethics, and philosophy. He wanted us to know that we did not need to feel ashamed of being Muslim, and to look to those examples of Arabs who contributed to the world, not to the hoodlums we saw on television and in the often rougher, crime-ridden communities of Northeast Edmonton. Uncle Yazan always respected the youth. He would stand up and shake our hands when he saw us, and he knew how to talk to us at our level. He was generous, paying for things and never wanting anything in return. But more than that, he taught us to love ourselves and where we came from. He would share snippets of Arabic history with us, including the contributions Arabs had made to the arts and sciences. Ibn Sina, known to the West as Avicenna in medicine, Ibn Rushd, Averroes in scientific and religious ethics, Al-Hazali, Al-Ghazal in algebra. He told us that there were 22 Arabic countries and over a billion Muslims in the world at that time. In 2015, the Pew Research Center estimated there were close to 1.8 billion Muslims, or 24% of the world's population. Just like Uncle Faisal, my honorary uncle, Yazan Haymour, was always available when I needed support. I went to Uncle Yazan with my personal and sometimes even trivial problems. When my parents were splitting up, I lived with my father. One day, I went to visit my mother and noticed she was wearing earrings. It may seem like a small thing, but my dad had a phobia of earrings and objected to anyone wearing them around him. When my mom wore them at home, I knew she was doing it just to antagonize him, and it upset me. I went to Uncle Yazan crying about how my mother wore earrings at home. Uncle Yazan calmed me down and smiled. "It is okay, Mwafa," he said. "It is a natural reaction to now being set free from your father. It is just a phase, and they will get back together." He was not always right, but he knew how to make me feel better. As teens, we would tell him, "These girls love us, Uncle Yazan." "Of course they do, of course they do," he'd reply. "The Arabs are the most handsome people in the world." He made us believe it. We clung to this belief, especially since we never heard it anywhere else. Like many teenage guys, we thought about girls constantly, even as we were overprotective of our sisters. Uncle Yazan understood how high school students were often thinking about things other than studies and homework, and he took our concerns seriously. We all appreciated that. Failure to keep a family and marriage together represented the defeat of our Palestinian nation, now fragmented as well, and my parents were the only Palestinian couple I knew who were splitting up. I was on edge and didn't entirely understand why. The hardest question to face in our small community was, "How are your parents doing, Mwafa?" The reality contained in this question that others knew about the collapse my parents were enduring hurt as much as the racism I faced every day. On our return to Edmonton from Montreal, I attended Queen Elizabeth High School, which had a large population of Arab students. The Arab students took to hanging out in big groups, partly to avoid getting beaten up by racist whites. The fights we got into now were more violent than they had been in junior high at Dickensfield, and sometimes involved knives and sticks, and we needed to protect ourselves. Yet there was something about being part of a big group that tempted us to abuse our collective power. We could see that some of the students were afraid of us, and we enjoyed watching them treat us with a sort of fake deference. Since many of the Arab students at Queen Elizabeth were of Lebanese descent, other students soon started referring to the group I hung out with collectively as Lebs. Many Arab kids took advantage of the newfound reputation we enjoyed as part of the Lebs, and very soon younger Arab kids no longer hung out with us because we were a cultural safety net. Now it was just about status, about feeling powerful. Quite a few Lebs got into the local bar scene, which was pretty violent, and some of them got into crime and drugs. After a while, it became embarrassing to be identified as a Leb because it meant you were a hoodlum. All the same, it gave us a sense of belonging in a school environment that often consciously alienated us. By the time I was in grade 11, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service started to take an interest in me. It was Uncle Yazan who told me about this. He said it was because I encouraged some of the younger students who looked up to me to wear the Palestinian keffiyeh. I had also given them stick-on temporary tattoos of the Palestinian flag, an idea I'd come up with after watching the Mexican gang movie Blood In, Blood Out. He wasn't trying to frighten me, but I was really scared. Ever since the Gulf War, I'd heard about people being targeted and interrogated by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service and the RCMP. The Canadian Arab Federation responded by producing and distributing a series of Know Your Rights pamphlets among Arab communities in the city as a precautionary measure. I'd read one titled When CSIS Calls, and it scared me to think that a powerful organization like CSIS would think to come after a high school student. Did they have a whole file on me? Had they been following me, taking photos and making notes? Had they tapped our phone? I didn't know, and neither did Uncle Yazan. He just knew that I was being investigated. Knowing that I was under intelligence scrutiny made me feel even more unwelcome. Someone who added to my sense of alienation was Constable Case Modell, a police officer stationed at Queen Elizabeth High School. One day at the police station, a few of us were waiting for the release of our friend Nader, who was being questioned about a fight that had taken place at Northgate Bus Terminal. Constable Case Modell saw me. "What are you Lebs doing here? Were you in another fight again? Why don't you find something better to do, like drive a cab or something?" I had always found it frustrating that people called me a Leb, despite the fact that I made a point of asserting publicly that I was Palestinian. But Constable Case Modell had done more than just that. He had not only made a racist generalization, but he also implied that we were inferior and had limited potential. I wish I had filed a complaint against him, but I was a 16-year-old who didn't yet know you could do these things. It often seemed as though all white people were against us, but there was one who reached out to our community. While in high school, I met Mr. Dennis Koch through my friend Jihad. As the teacher liaison, Mr. Koch's role at the school had to do with career development and counseling. He didn't seem popular with the other teachers. He was the kind of guy one suspects ended up sitting alone in the teacher's lounge. Dennis Koch was unique. He worked with the Arab community and with CAFA in a way we were not used to and seemed to know and to understand both worlds. He was one of the few white people I can recall from my youth who saw us as human beings. He treated us with respect, was a great listener, and always had memorable advice like, "Working hard is fine, but working smart is better." Somehow, through Dennis Koch and through CAFA and its youth group, we found ways to deal with our issues and to work with those few police officers, counselors, and teachers who seemed to want to help. With their involvement, school violence was reduced significantly, but unfortunately, the racist attitudes lingered. There did not seem any way racism could be eliminated without painting everyone white, and even then, some people would still notice the paint and point to the difference. It was after the Gulf War, when many Arab youth were involved in fights and petty crime, and Mr. Koch, together with Uncle Yazan at CAFA, created a youth club called Harmony in the Halls to combat violence within our school. My friends Chadi, Nidal, Marwan, and I started attending Harmony in the Halls events and even got a Harmony in the Halls award for being peacemakers in the school. It was quite a change from being branded a troublemaker. Slowly, my mind turned from causing trouble to thinking about my future and going to university. I left the rowdy crew behind and began to get my life back into shape, even though some called me and my friends who were also trying to clean up their acts rats for leaving the rebellious life. But we had matured and had decided to focus on something that we considered more important. 10. A Thirst for Knowledge. For years, I hadn't cared much about school, but my interest in education and my determination to succeed academically gradually began to grow. As I engaged more with peers at CAFA and at Harmony in the Halls, I realized that education was the only way for me to escape the sense of confinement that came with not belonging. This is something many first-generation immigrants and their children experience and can understand. When you feel you don't belong, it feels as if you get cut off from opportunities. People are unwilling to engage with you as a friend and an equal. In racialized communities, you sense the prejudice. As a child, I felt cloistered by this lack of engagement and opportunity. One of the emotional aspects of immigration is grief. Grief at the loss of a homeland, and also grief at the perceived loss of one's culture and language. Immigrants deal with these feelings of loss in similar ways to how people deal with death. There is denial, anger, depression, bargaining, and, for most immigrants, eventual acceptance of the change. Everyone works through these stages at their own pace, and as I look back at my life, I can see many of these elements of grief in the trajectory of my own family. Though my father was somewhat indifferent about the value of education at the time, my mom pushed me. Her family valued education. Her mother's family were professionals from the city of Jaffa, which is more cosmopolitan than Lida, my father's birthplace. Along with my mother, it was Uncle Yazan, my mentor, who encouraged me. I was 16 when my parents separated and my mother moved to Vancouver. My brother Omar and I went to live with my father. It was not an easy time. Dad did not take the separation well. His mental health declined, and being on the road for long stretches of time for his work made his sense of loneliness worse. After a year of mostly looking after myself, I decided to make the break and live independently. I found a place near the Coliseum station and was barely scraping by as I worked to finish high school. I wanted to go to university, but was worried that the same level of ostracization and alienation that haunted me at school would follow me there. When I was 17, some friends who were already in university told me about the Arab Students Association at the University of Alberta. That convinced me that I would find a support community there, so I applied and got accepted. The only other option I could foresee at the time was for me to work in the family giftware business, which my father had run for over 20 years with my uncle Faisal, who taught him the ropes when he left the cement factory. I respected what they had done, but had no desire to follow in their footsteps. Uncle Faisal was bitter about the fact that he'd had to put aside his education and career to help support the family in the El Hussein refugee camp in Amman. I also knew how bitter my father was about not being able to continue his pharmacy work in Canada. I decided the wisest choice would be to pursue a university education. When I was growing up, very few people in my Arab community went to university. When I was contemplating university, Mo Smiley, a Lebanese-Canadian acquaintance, asked me, "Why would you go to university? You can work and make much more money. Think about it, you're 17, and if you work for 10 years and save $1,000 a month, at age 27 you could have $120,000. It was appealing. "I really don't care about the money," I replied. "Are you nuts?" said Mo. "You could have it made rather than spending a boatload of money to go to school, then have to pay that off, then have to find a job, no guarantees." Mo didn't understand why I had to go to university, but when I began talking about post-secondary education, many people who had known me through high school began to treat me with respect, although they wondered if this was really me. I chose to study political science because I had grown up in a politicized environment and thought this would be a good direction for someone with my interest in politics. In the first month of classes, I found myself desperately trying just to understand concepts like socialism, communism, and the Canadian parliamentary system, let alone attempt to discuss them at a complex intellectual level. This whole thing was a mistake, I thought. "You should go into the Faculty of Business," said my close friend Bashar. "What are you doing in arts? You won't make any money." I listened to Bashar, even though I told Mo Smiley I wasn't interested in money. I changed course and registered for a Bachelor of Commerce. I loved the University of Alberta. It was here, among people who understood my difficulties with fitting in, that my sense of being Arab in the world really began to become defined. Even so, I soon noticed differences in our childhood. Many of the other Arab students had not grown up shopping at Byway. They were clean-cut and much more stylish and academic than my high school friends from the North Side. The perception in Edmonton was that the rougher, more troublesome, and more cultural Arabs lived in the north end of the city, and that they were unlikely to go on to university. I didn't know many other Arab Canadians pursuing higher learning, but Statistics Canada had figures that might have shocked people, like Constable Case Modell. In 2001, 74% of Arab Canadians aged 15 to 24 were enrolled in a full-time educational program, compared with 57% of all Canadians in that age group. Canadians of Arab origin were twice as likely as other Canadians to have a university degree. In fact, in 2001, 30% of Arab Canadians aged 15 and over had a bachelor's or postgraduate degree, twice the percentage of the overall adult population. Also, the proportion of Arab Canadians holding either a master's degree or doctorate, 10% of adults, was twice as high as that of all Canadian adults. These turn-of-the-millennium opportunities available to me in Canada contrasted sharply with the opportunities my father had had when he was growing up. Although even the refugee camps had schools, things got tough after the Six-Day War and the capture of the West Bank, and after the First and Second Intifada. With high birth rates and little land for new buildings and agriculture, overcrowding and rising unemployment became harsh realities for Palestinians. Few college-educated Palestinians in the Middle East could find work related to their degrees. In some ways, I had it easy in Canada. For one, there was no open war zone. However, I struggled with living alone after I had moved out and my mother had moved with my brothers and sisters to Vancouver. My dad stayed in Edmonton, but he worked out of town for his wholesale business, and I rarely saw him. I felt like a teenage orphan, carrying the awful feeling of family separation with me. This was something I could not solve with fighting. Although divorce is not forbidden in Islam, modern Levantine culture, that is to say, the area covered roughly by Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, and parts of Turkey, stigmatizes those who separate and divorce. Since a large portion of the Edmonton Arab community came from those regions, people looked down on our family. I noticed how my family was no longer invited to other people's homes or to weddings. Even members of our own family avoided us. There was nothing I could do about my parents' divorce, but it did not stop me from feeling ashamed. Fortunately, other adults stepped in to support me, like Uncle Faisal and Auntie Khadija, and Uncle Andy, Adnan, a dollar store pioneer who paid my rent for almost 2 years while I was at university. At university, my sense of not belonging began to ease. I still felt lonely at times, but I was also becoming part of a close-knit community. When I worked as a purchasing assistant at Brio Beverages one summer, Marwan, the mother of my co-worker Marwan, would send me food every day with her son. Everyone seemed to want to feed me and keep me going. One night at Thanksgiving, when I had just sat down to watch TV and eat a bit of chicken with stovetop stuffing, my friend Bashar knocked on the window. He saw me eating alone and started to cry, as if I were in the depths of poverty. "Come on," he sobbed. "You're coming home with me." It was a homemade turkey dinner I will never forget. A year later, I was living closer to the university with the Fayyad brothers, Sami and Talal, from Lac La Biche. We found a place near the university, a few steps away from Grandin Station. Talal and Sami were wonderful people, kind and considerate, and great partners for playing Sega video games with, or for walking all over downtown or going to the occasional party. They also provided me with a sense of belonging that I had not felt before. The Muslim community in Lac La Biche has roots that go back to the 1940s, and the Fayyads were among the early Lebanese settlers there. I did not think of myself as the most intelligent person in my circle, but I had strong ambition and a drive to succeed and to make something out of myself. I had always pushed out in front, whether starting prayer classes and wearing the keffiyeh in grade 8 or starting a fight in my high school years. If I had made it this far, I knew, nothing could hold me back from accomplishing whatever I wanted to achieve. I began to get active with the university's Arab Student Association, which worked to organize students on campus and to plan the annual Arab Awareness Week. I became a social convener, organizing events and meetings in my first and second years. By my third year, I was vice president of the ASA, and in my fourth year, I became the president. One night in my second year of university, I was helping to organize an alcohol-free dinner and theater event at a local burger joint called Red Robin when one of the first-year students turned to me. "Mwafa, I am so proud of you," she said. "Why?" "When I was at school, I heard so many bad things about you getting into trouble, but you have proved all those people wrong, and I just wanted to let you know that." Her remarks caught me off guard. I had worked hard to become a better person, but no one had told me before that they had noticed the changes in me. It felt good to hear her say such things about me. In high school, I had occasionally imagined myself becoming a police officer, despite my troubles with the law at that time. I was tall, strong, and quick to learn. It could be a secure job. Perhaps it was simply a reaction to my experiences with Constable Case Modell that had made me want to change the culture of the organization from within, but in the end I decided to go to university instead. One person in our community did join the police force, and few people I knew respected him. In the Northside Edmonton community at the time, police were seen as aggressive, hostile, and racist. While I do think attitudes have changed and that it is more acceptable for members of the Arab community to join the police, at the time he was treated with suspicion as a sellout. "I'm just doing my job," he would say when people confronted him. This officer was a friend of my cousin Nidal, and we visited him once at his house. He struck me as a very decent person. He was very humble and loved being a police officer. He saw his career as an opportunity to do something good, but I had the feeling he was usually alone. Edmonton is a small city, and when I was studying at the University of Alberta, I ran into a specter from my past in the washroom in Hub Mall one day. It was Constable Case Modell. I approached him. "Constable Case Modell, how are you doing? What are you doing at the university?" I asked. He looked confused. "Hi, who are you again?" Before I could answer, he continued, "I'm here as part of a community outreach program to talk to students about our activities." I wondered if he remembered telling me I should aspire to do something useful, like driving a cab. Instead, I said, "Tell me, Constable Case Modell, are you still a racist?" "No, no, you have it all wrong." He blushed and quickly washed his hands before walking out. I stood there with my mouth agape. I wanted to continue the conversation. I wanted to ask him a million questions so that I could understand how he could do community outreach when he'd said so many awful things to us when we were at school. It was obvious that he had not remembered who I was, nor had he shown any awareness of what he had done to me and other friends with his white supremacist remarks when we were in high school. However, in the mirror, I could see the look of anger rising in my face. It made me pause. I'd said what I'd most wanted to say to him. Something that had bugged me for years had been fixed. On second thought, nothing was fixed, but I had taken a step towards fixing it. I had named discrimination and challenged it without resorting to physical violence, as I might have done a few years ago. Reporter and author Zuhair Kashmiri has written dozens of stories about violence, hatred, fear, and interrogation. In The Gulf Within, Canadian Arabs, Racism, and the Gulf War, he looks at the work of a Montreal-based Arab-Muslim psychiatrist who was working long hours to try to help people, including kids, who were suffering from the stress of being profiled and discriminated against. His examination of the Arab-Muslim psyche, even among second- and third-generation Canadians, found that Arab-Muslims in Canada were battered and brutalized physically and emotionally. After the Gulf War, a national monitoring group, Muslim Media Watch, was established to address the negative portrayals of Islam being in the media. What many people in our targeted community found just as frightening as the actual violence was the silence. We were either too visible and a target, or we were invisible, becoming mere shadows or nothing when we resisted victimization or needed healing. I know that there must have been organizations like CAFA or Al Rashid Mosque that spoke for us, but it did not feel like we had much support. I will never forget how lonely and helpless I felt when all the people in charge, the ones I had learned to look up to, couldn't help. And that included police officers like Constable Case Modell. Yes, his racist comments had spurred me on to complete 10 years of university, to make something of myself. But humiliation is not a nourishing motivator. In the lush North Saskatchewan River Valley at the Edmonton Heritage Festival and William Horolak Park, you could enjoy and get to know dozens of cultures, from the Ukrainian side of my friend Youssef's family to the Arab culture he and I share, and everything in between. There are many pavilions, performances, crafts, clothes, and food. In 1996, while volunteering with Uncle Yazan at the Arabic Pavilion, I began talking to a passerby. He was an older fellow, maybe in his 70s, and presented white. "My great-grandfather was Lebanese," he told me. "Oh, so you speak Arabic?" I asked. "No," he replied. "My family has lost touch with our Arab roots." I do remember my grandmother making us kibbeh and labneh when I was young. "I would really like to know more about your culture." I thought to myself, this is my mother's worst nightmare for her children, needing to go to a stranger to ask about our culture. How humiliating. This man was several generations away from his Arab roots, and all he had left was the memory of a few dishes. It was then that I began to understand why my parents had tried to instill these things in me, why they had done some of the things they did. That man in Horlock Park was seeking to fill a void, and I vowed that I would not let that happen to me or to my children. In response, I began to explore my cultural roots with renewed interest and began to notice how other Arab Canadians around me were losing their heritage. In 1997, when I was in my second year of university, Edmonton hosted a national Canadian conference for Arab youth that had been organized by the Canadian Arab Federation. On the first night of the conference, a group of us went out to a restaurant. When the server came to take our drinks order after we sat down, I heard a young Lebanese woman say, "Yes, I'll have a beer, please." I stared at her, thinking my eyes and ears were playing tricks on me. I could not recall ever seeing an Arab woman drink alcohol, and most certainly not in public. I was shocked. I had grown up around the mosque, sheltered and supported by protective parents and tradition. For me and my friends, alcohol was completely off limits, and yet here this woman was, ordering a beer as if it was a glass of water. I knew not all Arabs were Muslims, and she may well have been a Christian, but I felt ashamed and embarrassed on her behalf. Slowly, I began to realize that the Arab community in Edmonton was in many ways more conservative and traditional than Arab communities elsewhere in Canada. My undergraduate years changed me. I had been surprised that I had even been accepted into university and took the chance with my whole being. I really struggled during my first year. I had never really studied much at school, and in my first year I struggled to come to terms with the change in culture from my school days. When I started, I still wanted to cause a bit of trouble and get up to mischief, but the other students were less accepting of bad behavior than my school friends had been. I felt immature compared to them and began to take a close look at my behavior and my actions. Over the course of that year, I slowly realized that the students around me, those who came from other communities, wanted to talk about science, politics, and religion, and not about who got shot or jumped. That was vastly different from my experience growing up in Northeast Edmonton, where these were common topics of conversation. I began to surround myself with Arab youth who never got into trouble, and several of those people remain role models for me. In my second year, I took my studies more seriously, and it paid off. Other students began to come to me for help. I liked being noticed for the good things I was doing, not for my rebellious past. I graduated from the University of Alberta with a degree in commerce with distinction, specializing in management information systems. One day, a professor, Dr. Mike Carter, came to deliver a talk at the university about a master's program in healthcare information systems in the Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering at the University of Toronto. I applied and, to my surprise, got accepted into the program. Both my parents were proud of my achievement, and my mother wished me success in a new city, but my father struggled with the fact that it meant I would be leaving Edmonton. Our family was already broken up by the divorce, and he could not understand why I would want to move away and splinter it even further. But in the end, he realized I had to do what was best for my future. On the 25th of August, 1999, I packed my things and boarded a plane to Toronto. Except for our stopover on the way to Montreal when I was 15, I had never been in Toronto. Though I had moved out of home at age 17, this was the first time I had left Alberta on my own to live in another place. It felt like everything was being pulled away from under my feet, everything warm and familiar, even the things that bugged me. I did not have much money, but I did have some papers that were priceless to me, especially a handwritten note in Arabic from my mother that I had received almost a year after she had moved to Vancouver with my brothers and sister. Salam alaikum wa rahman Allahu wa barakatuh. In the name of Allah, the most gracious and most merciful. My beloved son, Muafa. I am writing this letter because I wanted to let you know that we are doing well in Vancouver. We have moved to the Vancouver suburb of Richmond, and we found a two-bedroom apartment where things are a little cramped, but for now it will suffice until things get better. Your brother Bilal is working part-time at Bella Pizza. Omar is still engaging in his mischievous door-to-door chocolate almond sales. Saleh is going to school, and Wafa is also doing well in high school and planning to go to Jordan this summer to visit family. I know reading this letter is hard for you, as you may blame me for the separation of the family. I know that you are angry and upset with me. I just wanted to let you know that I never meant for this to happen. I always wanted our family to be together. I wanted to let you know that I love you, and I am so sorry that you have to suffer alone as a result of what has happened. Please do not worry about us, as Allah will take care of us. We live close to the mosque, and we try to go there as much as we can. I am teaching Arabic at the mosque and trying to register your brothers and sister into the Islamic program. We are doing fine, and I want you to focus on your studies. I am so proud of you and what you are accomplishing in university. I know it has not been easy living alone, separated from us, but do not worry, we will be together soon. Just focus on your studies and your future for now. My beloved son, I leave you now and I pray for your success. Remember to keep Allah present in your daily life and do not forget to do your daily prayers that will keep you connected with Allah. I love you and pray for you. Mom. I arrived in Toronto in late August with no place to live. A cab driver recommended a hostel. I sat there in a little single room, stunned and unprepared, my future hazy. I cried myself to sleep that first night. I felt alone and abandoned. I had lived alone for a year in Edmonton, but even then, friends and family were close. At university, I had shared accommodation with friends I could talk to. But now, for the first time in my life, I was truly on my own. There was no one there to support me or ask me how I was doing. I felt helpless. All the emotions from the past 2 years, my parents' separation and my father's struggles, came crashing down on me. On my second day in the city, I went to the University of Toronto. I discovered that there were students from over 100 countries. I found the campus big and spread out, with a great contrast between old castle-like buildings covered in ivy that usually indicated arts and social science programs, and new buildings that generally indicated science and technology. Waves of homesickness washed over me, and I felt dizzy and nauseated. Apart from those 3 years in Amman as a child and a few months in Montreal as a teenager, I hadn't lived anywhere other than Edmonton. I identified strongly with Edmonton's Castle Downs area, the mall, schools, and the Al-Rashid Mosque. Everything here was strange and unfamiliar. So I went to student housing. "We're so sorry, but you've arrived a little late. I don't know if there's anything we can help you with." I grabbed a newspaper and found a place to sit on the green space near the huge Robarts Library. I felt dispirited as I started browsing the paper, looking for places to stay. I wanted to be close to the university so that I could engage easily and actively in the student community. I wanted somewhere I could fit in, and preferably a place where I could be among people who shared my faith and my cultural background, but I couldn't find anything like that. I was still staying at the hostel, and I knew I needed to find more permanent accommodation before classes started in a few days' time. Sitting there on the lawn, I could see a large glass door about 100 meters from the library. They led to a place called Earnscliffe College. I did not know the place, but I thought it was worth going to see whether they had any places available. It was locked, but I pressed the doorbell. A gentleman in his 40s opened the door and greeted me. I immediately felt better, though my heart was hammering inside my chest. He introduced himself as the director of the college. His name was Jose. "Sounds like Hausa," I thought. Jose was from Peru. "Do you have any rooms for rent?" I said, my heart still pounding. He smiled. "Yes, but we are very selective. We only take students with good marks and strong resumes. We want high achievers." I told him that I had graduated with distinction from my university and that I had been accepted as a graduate student in engineering. That got me a tour of the place, a beautiful building with clean rooms, a gym, a small library, a meeting room, and even a prayer chapel. I asked him about the chapel. Jose said, "This is a Christian college that is part of a Catholic organization. and we have rules for everyone who lives here. I asked him what the rules were, wondering if I'd have to do something Christian. I could imagine my mother having fits. Good behavior, he answered, with a nightly curfew of 11 p.m. on weekdays and 1 a.m. on weekends, and participation in the nightly get-togethers. We are like a family, a home away from home. Residency here included 3 meals a day, laundry, having your room cleaned 3 times a week, and even late-night snacks. At $750 a month, it sounded like a deal. Jose gave me a form. Complete this and send me your transcripts and your resume, and we will consider your application. I filled out the application form and delivered it and a copy of my transcripts that same day. I was accepted. It was not the Muslim community I had set out to find, but at the time, finding a space in Earnscliffe College felt more like an intervention from a higher being than a coincidence. After my night of loneliness, I had found a place that I could call home. In response to my father's struggles, and my own, I had increasingly explored piety in my own life, and at Earnscliffe, piety was a cornerstone of daily life. That appealed to me. So did the structured life, something I had not had before. At Earnscliffe, I lived with about 50 students and 15 adults who worked for the church, as well as a handful of clergy who led worship in the faith of the Christian God. The religious adult staff all held prestigious positions in areas like engineering, music, public relations, and CEO headhunting, while the students were studying engineering, pre-med, English, and history. The residence was associated with the Opus Dei organization, a controversial part of the Catholic Church. Opus Dei or not, the Earnscliffe College residence was, apart from the curfews, one of the best places I had ever lived in. I had thought it would be difficult to adjust to living in such a deeply Christian environment, because even though Islam and Christianity are both Abrahamic faiths, and the Islamic faithful share a belief in the same monotheistic God as Christianity and Judaism, the tenets of my faith differ significantly from these religions. Unlike Christians, Muslims do not see Jesus, Isa in Arabic, as the Son of God who was sacrificed for humanity, but as a prophet. We regard Muhammad as God's final messenger, and his teachings permeate our whole culture and lifestyle. It is everything. Although our faiths share the same roots in the Middle East, the history of our relationship is complicated. When I arrived at Earnscliffe, I was told that we were expected to practice our faith and the faculty lived by example. Members of Opus Dei follow the Catholic liturgy of the hours, which requires the faithful to pray 5 times a day, much like Islam requires the faithful to observe daily prayers. Even though life at Earnscliffe revolved around an expression of Catholic faith, no one ever, directly or indirectly, tried to preach Christianity to me. However, the resident priest, Father Craig, did ask me regularly if I was doing my Muslim prayers, which I confess I was not really doing at the time, with the exception of the Friday prayer. At Earnscliffe, we were all here for a specific purpose: to go to school, to work, and live together. Every night we would sit down together as a group, and everyone would talk about what they had done that day. It was like being part of a family. We were expected to dress for mealtimes, especially Sunday dinners. I remember coming to dinner one Sunday wearing sweats and a t-shirt, and being asked to go change into something more appropriate. My mother had brought me up to show respect and self-respect, but Earnscliffe worked on a different level, and it was a shock to adapt to this more formal environment. Despite what I'd achieved in university to that point in my life, spending so much time among high-achieving students often made me feel like a country hick from Western Canada who had come to the big city not knowing much. While I was happy on many levels at Earnscliffe, I struggled to fit in intellectually. Being among all those high-achieving peers made me feel that somehow I had been disadvantaged growing up in an immigrant family in the north side of Edmonton. The other residents at Earnscliffe seemed so intelligent and intellectual and used words I did not understand and had never heard before. I remember we were watching a hockey game one day. When my team, the Edmonton Oilers, scored, I would yell things like awesome or amazing. When the other team scored, their supporters used words I'd never heard before, like stupendous and astonishing, to describe a goal. I tried to become more intellectual by hanging around them and listening to their conversations, but I longed to learn more about my own culture, too, so I started looking for opportunities to engage more with Arabic culture. Among the confusion of groups at the U of T International Center, including the Ahmadiyya Muslim Students Association and the 12 Imams Muslim Students Association, it was the Muslim Students Association, MSA, that sounded the most similar to the group I had been involved in Edmonton, so I joined. I encountered many other kinds of groups, too, secular groups that I had not been aware of, like the Rotary Club. One day, I started talking to a man who was a member of the Rotary Club. He told me they had a grant for students with high marks who were in financial need and encouraged me to apply. 3 weeks later, I received a check for $3,000. I still wish I could thank him in person. With that money, I was able to pay for a few more months at the Earnscliffe College residence and finally felt that I would get by in Toronto. As I moved deeper into university life, I began to meet more people I could identify with, one of whom was Abdul Razak Takriti. A second-year undergraduate student in political science and history, he frequently wore the Palestinian keffiyeh, especially during the cold winter months. It was easy to find him in a crowd. He came from a wealthy Jordanian family and was an ambitious young man who was out to change the world. After finishing his master's degree, he went on to the Oxford University for his PhD. One night in Toronto, I met with him and another fellow, Muhammad, at one of the university's restaurant pubs for an Arab Student Association party. I wasn't used to these kinds of parties. For one thing, they served alcohol, and I found myself staring at men and women partying, drinking, dancing, and talking to each other very freely. Back home in Edmonton, even though the University of Alberta Arab Student Association and the Canadian Arab Friendship Association were seen by some as liberal, our events never had alcohol. There had always been parents at the larger functions, and girls were chaperoned by their brothers, who took their duty seriously. We might call Islam a religion of peace, but there would be no peace for the guys who went after our sisters. Being at this MSA event in Toronto felt more like being at a nightclub. While I was playing pool, I asked a guy, "Isn't this kind of strange and different from our culture?" He aimed the cue, slammed a ball into the pocket, and then grinned and said, "I have no problem with this. It's normal." Others agreed and even seemed surprised that I asked. I began to feel like even more of a conservative, constrained Arab redneck from Alberta. I could feel my skin prickle. I asked one guy whose sister was at the party, "Aren't you worried if someone flirts with her?" He shrugged and said, "Hey, it's her life, and I'm okay with it." One day I was sitting in a Toronto cafe with my friend Abdul and a few other people. They were getting loud about American intervention in the Middle East and how the United States was a colonial superpower that has caused much more harm than good in the world. I told them what my father had told me about receiving USAID donations in the refugee camp in Amman, Jordan. They all laughed. "Yes, that is fine, and it helped your father and others survive day to day. But look at the larger picture. America has damaged the world by acting as an intervening power in the world, dictating how every region should be run." While feeling like an idiot, I could see the truth in this. The discussion piqued my curiosity. I wanted to learn more. Abdul suggested that I read a book called Orientalism by Edward Said, a Palestinian-American scholar and public intellectual. The book describes the subtle but strong Eurocentric prejudice shown towards Arab-Islamic people and their cultures, which are often seen as exotic and backwards. Said demonstrates how colonial powers control knowledge production in universities and in media representations. Abdul also recommended other books with similar themes, like Noam Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, which looks at the propaganda, distortion, and corporate sponsorship of major news outlets. As I was reading these books, I realized how limited my vocabulary was. I was intellectually small, a puny cardamom seed. I bought an Oxford dictionary and proceeded to write down any word I didn't understand in a notebook. Within a few months, I had collected over 2,000 words. I began to read voraciously, going to the dictionary over and over, trying to understand and use more words. Still, my health policy professors, who I looked up to since they advocated for quality in public health care, told me that my writing was under par for a graduate student. So I bought A Canadian Writer's Reference and soaked up grammar, basic sentence structure, vocabulary, and referencing styles. I became more confident and wrote articles for newspapers, as well as letters to the editor. It became clear to me how important writing skills are to success in university programs, and though my surname means confused, I was determined that my writing wouldn't reflect that. I was also coming back to the energy I had for writing when I was a kid, before other people's assumptions got in the way. I had already come a long way since Edmonton. Reading books and meeting with people who knew more than I did constantly reminded me that I could have been born a struggling Palestinian in a camp, and this encouraged me to work harder. In Toronto, my hunger for learning more about Islam, Arab culture, and the history of my people continued to grow. I began to attend various lectures outside of the university classes I was taking. Uncle Yazan had told me about some of the people I heard about in these talks, like the great 12th century Muslim leader Saladin. I began to look for more. On eBay, along with some old Arabic coins, I found two books that I came to treasure, one by Abu E. Walid Muhammad bin Ahmad bin Rushd, also known as Ibn Rushd or Averroes, and one by the great Muslim philosopher Ibn Khaldun. Reading these books about two exceptional Muslims who helped shape European thinking, I could not help but think, why wasn't I ever taught about them in school? Averroes was a great 12th century Muslim scholar who wrote more than 67 original works, 20,000 pages covering a variety of subjects, including early Islamic philosophy, logic in Islamic philosophy, Arabic medicine, mathematics, astronomy, grammar, Islamic theology, Sharia, Islamic law, fiqh, Islamic jurisprudence, and grammar, as well as commentaries on most of Aristotle's works and on Plato's Republic. I found myself shutting out the world and disappearing into this new world of knowledge I had discovered. Over 1,000 years ago, I learned, the city of Baghdad contained Bayt al-Hikmah, the House of Wisdom, which was considered the top intellectual establishment of the time. It held one of the greatest collections of knowledge in the world, with books on every subject and in many languages. There were so many scholars that this library had to keep building and expanding to contain all that world knowledge. I kept going back to things like the pharmacy section, thinking, Yaba, what an ancient and honorable profession you chose. There was so much I had never been exposed to in high school and university. It was as if Muslims, Islam, and the Arabs had been wiped out of the whole curriculum. I was taught about the Jewish Holocaust, but not the tragedy of the Nakba, about the persecution of Jews during the Spanish Inquisition, but not about the persecution of Muslims and the push to expel them from the Spanish mainland. And so it continued from my backyard in Edmonton to the West Bank. I could see attempt after attempt to destroy Arabic peoples and cultures, but nothing that would acknowledge the many contributions Muslims had made to Western culture. What I was hearing now as an Arab Muslim in Canada was, you are a threat to us, or you are at the bottom of the ladder, below the first rung, in the dirt, like in the Israeli-occupied territories of Palestine. So many questions arose within me, and the need to find answers grew stronger. During the summer of 2000, I left Earnscliffe and found a place to stay in a mixed dormitory in Trinity College. After living in a men's-only environment, I found it difficult to adjust. I was shocked, for instance, to see women walking around in their underwear, and even more so by the fact that it did not seem to bother a friend of mine who came from Jordan. One night, I locked myself out of my dormitory and had to sleep on the couch. It was clear other students had had a party and had not cleaned up, for there were beer bottles everywhere. In the morning, one of the nuns walked in and saw me lying there in the midst of all these bottles. She accused me of irresponsible behavior, even though she knew I did not drink. Then she left and came back with signs that said, "Drink in moderation," which she put up all over the place. It hurt to see how easily she had made assumptions and put the blame on me. One night, towards the end of my graduate studies, I watched the movie Malcolm X with some of the other people in my dormitory. It affected me deeply, and the very next day I went out to buy Alex Haley's The Autobiography of Malcolm X. I read passages from the book over and over. Halfway through the book, I started to really understand what Malcolm X meant about the struggle against white people. There were not many whom he found good in his life. Instead, they used black people as they saw fit, exploiting and destroying them. In school, Malcolm X was told he might become a carpenter if he was lucky, certainly not a lawyer, which he longed to be. This brought to mind Uncle Faisal, who had to leave school to help support his family in the Palestinian refugee camp and became a carpenter. Whether it was history, philosophy, African languages, law, the Muslim faith, or any other subject you could imagine, Malcolm X was determined to study it, to raise himself above what white people told him he could be. To me, one of the best statements in his autobiography is this: "I would just like to study. I mean, ranging study, because I have a wide open mind. I'm interested in almost any subject you can mention." That was what I felt in Toronto. I cry inside for those who have education denied to them. Education and being able to read is a weapon and a path towards healing. I can only imagine how students at the schools in Gaza and other terrorized zones feel when their buildings and classrooms are bombed and annihilated, ending up a heap of brick and glass, littered with charred scraps of paper. Like a flaming blockade of tires rolled into the streets, I was spinning with questions burning inside me. I had finally found positive motivation from the late Edward Said. Three of his many books, Orientalism, Covering Islam, How the Media and the Experts Determine How We See the Rest of the World, and his autobiography, Out of Place, were especially influential for me. In addition to the brilliance of his writing and debating, I appreciated him for his ability to live in two worlds, English and Arabic, all the while being an advocate for the Palestinian cause. Before he passed away, I had the opportunity to see Said speak in Toronto and was inspired by how he connected his struggles with identity and language to his practice as an academic. He told the audience that universities are part of the system of elite knowledge production that constructs a Western understanding of the East to further the goals of imperialism. He encouraged us to work from both inside and outside universities to decode the discrimination that has become accepted as curriculum. As I listened to him speak and let his writing sink into my life, I became aware of how I had been mocked for the way I spoke English, for my faith, and for my culture. I realized how these things made me an outsider in Canada, despite my status as a citizen, and how those at the center of power used my position as an immigrant as a sword against me. I began to realize that language could be used as a gate to keep certain groups excluded or stereotyped as uncivilized foreigners, or as immigrants who have not contributed to humanity's collective knowledge or to their adopted homes. Through Said and Malcolm X, I began to see myself differently and to have a faith in my abilities that I did not have before. I felt both comforted and upset by Said's insights, which helped me to understand the injustice that lay at the root of my family's past, present, and future experiences. In 2013, Najla Said, Edward Said's daughter and a renowned academic, playwright, actor, and activist in her own right, published a memoir. Though her background, gender, and religion are different from mine, her book, Looking for Palestine, Growing Up Confused in an Arab-American Family, made me shake with understanding. Yes, that's exactly how it is. I know what she means. With such books, how can we forget a culture or pretend it does not exist in all its diverse transnational forms? Feeling such a deep connection with literature and the life stories of people like me helped me continue to pursue my own career as a researcher and teacher. In December 1999, I returned to Edmonton for a visit. I joined Talal, the Lebanese-Ukrainian who was my old roommate at the University of Alberta, and his cousin Youssef at a local 24-hour diner on the north side of Edmonton. On that particular night, it was packed and we were enjoying our burgers, minding our own business, when a man at a table across from ours suddenly stood up and said in a loud voice, "I'm going to go to Bosnia and kill you Muslims." We stopped eating. The whole restaurant paused and looked at the spectacle that was unfolding. One of the other people at his table looked embarrassed. "Sorry about that," he said to us. "My soldier friend is drunk." Youssef was upset. He wanted to say something, but Talal and I stopped him. Then I did exactly what I'd just cautioned Youssef not to do. I spoke up. "You know what?" I said to the soldier. "I don't blame you for speaking like that, because your father probably spoke in the same manner. Please sit down. Thank you very much." Part of me wanted to add, "My friend here is part Ukrainian, as many of you are too," but it didn't feel like that would translate. His friend pulled him back into his seat, but the man stood up again and repeated his words, "I'm going to go to Bosnia to kill you Muslims." Again, the restaurant went quiet. Still, no one in the entire restaurant said a word. The man's friend, the one who had apologized earlier, apologized once more for his friend. Then the soldier yelled out for a third time. The tension at our table was palpable. What hurt most was the quiet complicity of all those who were watching the sequence of events. Youssef was ready to explode. "One more time, and I'm going to beat him up," he muttered. I asked the server to call someone, the police perhaps, but she shot back that the man was drunk and not hurting anyone. A few minutes later, the man made another obscene outburst about Muslims. This time, Youssef jumped up. "If you want to start killing Muslims, why don't you start with me? Let's go outside." Almost everyone in the restaurant spoke up. "Let him be. Leave him alone. He's drunk." These people had all been silent when he was threatening to kill Muslims. You could say it was because of the innate Canadian sense of politeness, but they were quite ready to speak up in his defense when the target of man's racial abuse stood up to respond. Just like that, Youssef had become the bad guy. Youssef and the other man stormed outside to fight, but Talal and I stayed behind. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the waitress speaking on the phone. She had called the police. I knew how this would end. I'd seen it happen many times before. I knew if the police came and saw a Leb apparently bashing a white man, they would put him in jail. And us too, if we were anywhere near them. Talal and I stood up and went outside. Youssef and the other guy were pushing each other around. We dragged Youssef away before the police came. We may not have ended up in prison that night, but it certainly felt like we might as well have escaped from one if the derisive looks people gave us on the way out of the restaurant was anything to go by.